The basic themes are from the book, Things That Make for Peace. We can tell you ahead of time what the different areas are going to be if you want to do some reading prior to the session. But we hope that it will be a way in which we can give some of the things that Mary and I are concerned about that are part of our life now, and that the individual discussions that follow it are also very much part of the presentations. I would like to be and continue to be a Lutheran pastor, a husband, father of four, working for social justice, and also be a contemplative monk. I'm aware of the great difficulty. Some of those things are energy consuming and time consuming and major commitments of your life. I think I'm over the major difficulty, and that is I had always been told the two were mutually exclusive. And I think until you break through that obstacle, you really don't have the possibility of understanding contemplative vision. We've been told that the accidents, the non-essentials around monkhood or monastic life were the essentials, such as male, celibate, cloistered. Thomas Merton has helped me understand that those are not the essence of what it means to be a monk. The essence, according to Merton, is someone who takes up a critical attitude toward the contemporary world and its structures and its values. And I don't know of any Lutheran pastor, husband, father of four, who doesn't want to be critical about some of the values and the structures of the world in which we live. And secondly, a monk is one who tries to unmask the illusions of society and who works to bring about change through spirit and truth. And I think I can affirm that. So I invite you to maybe a new understanding of what it means to be a monk, and also a new understanding of what it means to be a contemplative. A contemplative is not one who sits with a vacant stare and really obviously is out of it, or one who enjoys constant religious ecstasy. Let me tell you from Jim Carroll, a good friend of mine, some writing that he does about what it means to be a contemplative. He thinks that we have assumed that that's what a contemplative is in order to hide behind our definition so that we don't have to do praying. You are not a mystic, right? Neither am I. Mystics are exotic people who wear esoteric clothes, eat abstract food, and live in houses lined with ecstasy. Mystics do not exist. Mystics are heroes that people like you and me made up so that we could say real silence and serious praying are someone else's job. Real silence and serious praying are tough, and we are each called to nurture them. More and more lately, we know it. We are not mystics, nor are we acid heads, nor do we live in tree houses, but we are alive, and we do see. The fire that torments and consoles burns at the center of our own names. Each of us does his own breathing, and that's the beginning of serious prayer. Each of us does his own seeing, and that's the beginning of contemplative vision. The next mystic you meet, give him a dime, but don't hide behind him. So maybe if we can overcome also some of the hesitation about contemplatives, we can make a step forward. The contemplative is one who sees differently. And I want to refer to several things in the book that tried to highlight this. Merton says, and I'm on page 81 at the first part of that chapter called The Contemplative Vision. And he's speaking about the word contemplation. The worst disadvantage of this word is that it sounds like something, quote unquote, an objective quality, a spiritual commodity that one can procure, something that it is good to have, something which, when possessed, liberates one from problems and from unhappiness, as if there were a new project to be undertaken among all the million other projects suggested to us in our lifetime, that is, to become contemplatives. It is difficult for us to learn that the contemplative vision is an awareness, not a method. We confirm our misunderstanding when we continue to look for something else to read about contemplation instead of emptying ourselves and leaving ourselves open for the Spirit to work. One of the dangers in using the term contemplation is that it implies for most of us a kind of ecstasy and a measure of mystical union. But the heart of contemplation is to value what seems common and routine. The contemplative finds God in what is, in the ordinary, not above and beyond the things of this world. In other words, our basic difficulty is that contemplation is too simple for us to understand, not too complicated. Teilhard de Chardin said, all of life lies in that verb seeing. And therefore, I think maybe that's the place we ought to start if we're really concerned about the things that make for peace. To ask whether or not the way we see is the way of contemplation. If there would be a text, and if this were a sermon, it would be Matthew 6:22 from the Sermon on the Mount, where our Lord says, the eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is sound, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is not sound, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? Contemplation is not seeing some different world. It's seeing this one differently. Can you feel the difference between those two things? The early church fathers said the same thing in a beautiful way. The world tends to always have it in this order. Seeing is believing. And in talking about faith, the early church fathers reversed that and said, no, believing is seeing. And the nature of faith, I think, is understood if some of the truth of that comes through to us. And as far as I'm concerned, Mary can speak for herself when she has the time up here. This is the kind of introductory or key chapter to the book. It doesn't come at the beginning of the book, but for me it is the place to start. To invite people into a different way of seeing, I think, is a theme that runs throughout the things that she and I have tried to write. That as long as peace is the absence of conflict or tranquility or calmness, then there is a certain search for peace that I think will not lead to the biblical attitude of peace. There has to be a biblical way of seeing peace, not as the absence of conflict, but as a kind of wholeness with the themes of justice that the Old Testament concept of shalom has. A.J. Musty said, there is no way to peace. Peace is the way. And until you have that new way of seeing, you will think of peace as the destination at the end of the journey instead of the way you walk, instead of the way you travel. And it takes that new way of seeing until we understand that. Much of the peace, especially peace of mind literature, makes it a do-it-yourself kind of project to arrive at peacefulness instead of the gift that Scripture makes of it. In the chapter on none of the above, as long as nonviolence would be seen as some combination of neutrality, escape, capitulation, surrender, weakness, there will be no view of the biblical understanding of the power of the cross, that it is not the absence of power. It is a power. It's the foolishness of the power of the cross, but it is power. And when we take that chapter, I hope you'll feel that nonviolence, that part of our poverty is we do not have a positive word for that. Gandhi felt the need for it and has a word, satyagraha. But in English, we do not yet have a way to say that it's a positive force instead of only the absence of violence. And that takes a new way of seeing. If simplicity, and who would vote for complexity? I mean, simplicity sounds like a winner. But if simplicity is seen largely as a deprivation of my life, I take my present budget and because of world hunger, I'll cut out everything that's fun. That's a way of seeing, perhaps. I don't think it ends in much freedom. And I think for simplicity to be a new experience of grace and a new experience of freedom, it takes a different way of seeing. I'd like to try to share with you at least one instance in the past where we experienced that this new way of seeing was, in fact, the critical part of the revolution. Mary and I were part in the 60s of the black revolution in this country. We were outsiders to it because of the color of our skin, but we lived in the midst of it in Washington, D.C. In fact, up until this year, she and I were embarrassed as parents that our children were sent to Stevens Elementary School. Now we kind of brag about that because it's Amy Carter's own school, and now we feel like we were good parents and about 10 years ahead of our time. It's not much of a school, by the way, and I think we still have reason to wonder whether we were fair to our kids. But they were very much in a black world, and we lived in the same neighborhood. I think we sensed that the revolution can best be phrased, "Black is beautiful." There were a lot of things that came after that. There were civil rights movements and sit-ins and results of that revolution. But the revolution really came with a new way of seeing, and we sensed that in our neighborhood. Let me tell you some of the violence before that revolution. Our Community of Christ tried to have a tutoring program after school, and we looked for books for the kids to read, and all the books we found, religious or otherwise, pictured white children. So we searched for a long time so that some of the pictures of kids in the books, especially that preschoolers leaf through, had black children, and we finally found some. They were out on the table the first day, and Mushrat came in. All the kids in our neighborhood had nicknames. Maybe that's true of any inner city group, but it certainly was of ours. Mushrat's real name was Eric, and he was about 5. And he picked up one of the new books. He took one look and said, "I don't want that book. Those kids are dumb." He threw it down. Eric was already programmed that black meant dumb. And he had already looked in a mirror a long time ago, and he was black. That's a violence. But the revolution that black is beautiful changed the kind of perceptions that people had. It even changed what was good news or bad news. Before the revolution, good news in our neighborhood was, hey, they found a new hair straightener. After the revolution, when I can wear an afro, who needs their new product? And it seems to me something of those same kinds of revolutions have to take place. You have a little book in your bookstore, and Mary Hinderly gave it to me 3 years ago, about a year and a half before anybody else found it. It's called Small is Beautiful by E.F. Schumacher. I think it's one of the most significant books in the last 2 years. The subtitle is Economics as Though People Mattered. And I don't know whether E.F. Schumacher was part, because he is an English citizen, lived in England during these past years. I don't know if he saw the revolution, Black is Beautiful, but it seems to me his title invites you into the same kind of revolution. To say small is beautiful is a new way of seeing. That as long as the illusion is there that bigger is always better, we need a revolution so that the good news and bad news images that come to us get changed. Technology says, hey, we've got good news for you. There's a machine that means 10 people no longer have to work. And at some point, that's no longer good news. And his chapter on Buddhist economics says good news is to find a job that takes 4 people to do it because their community while they work is part of economics. That's a different way of seeing. And I think within our next decade, we're going to look at some Buddhist economics or some other name for it that's more humane. There's another phrase that I think is a revolution, and that's enough is enough. We're going to deal with that more tomorrow. But as long as we've been programmed to think that our appetites should and can be insatiable, we will never have enough. And we have been programmed to fight the limits, to always wait because the next model will be better, and to always be dissatisfied. And it's a revolution to say enough is enough and to begin to find our life within the limits instead of always fighting them. That's the kind of revolution that we invite you to today with this whole word contemplation. For the Christian, this new way of seeing comes in the radical commitment to Jesus Christ. It comes in a new biblical consciousness. And I guess I'm going to try to do this in Seattle in about a week. I'm going to walk into, and I've already heard, who goes in where angels fear to tread. I know the quote. I'm going to walk into the midst of the old fundamentalist liberal controversies on what is the Word of God. That's still a very active fight in our Lutheran churches. And I wish we could get beyond the old battles, because I think the old battles are keeping us from a biblical consciousness. They tend to both have the scientific image of me, of someone who has the microscope on the Word of God, of someone who's examining the texts. The fundamentalist tends to make sure he still has an inerrant, system without a mistake that all hangs together, and the liberal is looking to see whether there's any phrase that was part of the original codices that is still part of the Word of God. And when you get finished, neither of them brings you any excitement and it's anything but a living two-edged sword. And I think that's demonic because it doesn't let us see biblically. We spend our time asking what the Bible says. We're not invited to a biblical consciousness that's a new way of seeing. And I think, like Jim Carroll saying we're hiding behind the fact that only mystics can pray, I think we're hiding behind our controversy because part of that biblical way of seeing comes to us as risk. George Fox, the Quaker, and I'm not sure where he'd be on the liberal fundamentalist debate, but he has a phrase that helps me. He says, on the scriptures, make sure that you understand that you have to go through it to go to it. Now that's I think it's something you have to live with for a while. I'll repeat it once more, and you bat it around sometime. We're going to be here a week, and I'd be glad to know what it says to you. You have to go through it in order to go to it. That the Bible and that consciousness that brought it about is more descriptive than definitive. And we've tended to make it definitive. We've tended to make it a catechism. So you have to learn God is love as a definition of God. That's a betrayal of the fact that it was a confessional statement of someone who had experienced God as love and shared the experience, and then we make it a new definition. You feel the difference? You have to get behind it in order to see that way until it makes sense. It seems to me that's coming right around again to the church fathers, that it isn't seeing is believing, it's believing is seeing. And that requires a new radical way of looking. Yesterday I was privileged to be in on the four loves. Let me quote from page 110 of that and then make a point about this biblical way of seeing. Of all arguments against love, none makes so strong an appeal to my nature as careful that might lead you to suffering. To my nature, my temperament, yes, not to my conscience. When I respond to that appeal, I seem to myself to be 1,000 miles away from Christ. If I am sure of anything, I am sure that his teaching was never meant to confirm my congenital preference for safe investments and limited liabilities. I doubt whether there is anything in me that pleases him less. When John shared that yesterday from the book, I thought that takes a different way of seeing security and investments and safety and all of the other things that are part of my life. And I thought of a Clarence Jordan sermon. I don't know if you've ever heard him on tape or not. A delightful Georgia preacher. His accent is just delightful. He has cotton patch versions of the scripture. He has sermons on the Sermon on the Mount. And he's preaching in one of those from the Sermon on the Mount, and he has the text, "Take no thought for the morrow." And there's a long pause. And Jordan says, now if you haven't made a shift, a really fundamental shift, don't pay any attention to the last thing I just said. It is very poor advice. If you haven't made the shift, the idea of take no thought for the morrow is absurd. No, get all the insurance you can afford. And stocks and bonds and a fence around your house or whatever else security is, because that's what security is in that other kingdom. Only if you have that new way of seeing does it make any sense at all to say take no thought for the morrow, because there's a different understanding of what security means. It seems to me that the revolution is in that new way of seeing. There's another phrase that I think is part of a contemplative vision, and I want to share a little bit of it with you because I think if you just read the book, it would not come out at you maybe as very important, and I think it's one of the ways that we get at it. It's in the word disillusioned. In the bottom of page 85 is one of the sections on being disillusioned. And I tend to think of that word in a negative term because of the way we use it. Have you ever said, oh, I have a friend and he or she has become disillusioned? We tend to think of it as a kind of incapacitating place of despair. Well, it's a very positive word in another sense, in a contemplative sense. Contemplation is to be disillusioned. Illusion comes from the Latin word ludere, meaning to play. Illusion or living with an illusion is games playing. To play games is more comfortable than to deal with the reality of the way things are. If I am disillusioned, I become honest with myself and stop playing games. We have accepted so many illusions about life, the world, values, ourselves. To be disillusioned is to begin to see things as they really are. A contemplative lifestyle is one in which the disillusioning process carries over more and more into my daily thoughts, feelings, and decisions. Then, dropping down to the italicized part, Jim Carroll has some things about things for which we are to be disillusioned. Calling into question the perennial human assumptions around which men are always dancing, namely, that suffering and pain are to be avoided at all costs, that consumption of things, pleasures, and experiences makes a person happy, and the more one consumes, the better off one is. To sit still is to waste time. At another place, Jim Carroll says, someday he hopes that he'll get to the place where he can go fishing without the pole. That up until now in our society, if you're going to do that, if you're going to sit, you have to take the pole. Otherwise, they take you away. Or he adds, or at least think you're a Democrat on welfare. But someday he hopes to have the freedom to go fishing and not take the pole. The goal of life is to have whatever or whoever is old is obsolete, while whatever or whoever is new is good, indeed better. Permanent commitment is impossible and undesirable. Drugs, from alcohol to acid and aspirin, are good things. Sexual liberation means love is the only rule. Being radical means denying what went before. Those are the kinds of things that I think we should be disillusioned about. Let me share. I think sometimes they sound flip when people talk about being disillusioned, especially when they talk about being disillusioned about the United States. I don't think Jim is flip. And it seems to me one of the breakthroughs has to come, like William Stringfellow, who said, I want to see my country biblically. I do not want to see my Bible Americanly. And until that sounds like good theology and not treason, I'm not sure that gets through. But that is good theology. Jim Carroll has this section about being disillusioned about our own country. We're learning, and it's dated. It's the Nixon years. You'll understand that soon, but I'm not sure it's changed enough that the quote is not pertinent anymore. We are learning that among the benefits America offers its people are easy entrance into an entire worldview, a thorough system of ethical values, and a way of passing both on. In short, America offers its people its own kind of religion. The chief advantage of civil religion Americana is that you don't have to be religious to practice it. All one need believe about God is he's on our side. He lives somewhere between the 14th hole, the yacht club, and the foreign aid bill. The good news celebrated is that things will get better, especially for us. And the chief value proclaimed is blessed uniformity. More and more we all look alike, and that is the function both of American civil religion and McDonald's Enterprises Incorporated. And the evangelical impulses of American civil religion are channeled into the national task of building the one holy city, and therefore we go forth and Los Angelize all nations, in the name of bread that does not come down from heaven. Ecumenism has come to mean the papalization of Billy Graham, the Nixonization of Catholic bishops, and the Americanization of God, all celebrated non-denominationally each Sunday in the East Room, where presumably the sun starts its rising each day. The most frightening thing about the death of the old religious culture is the dawning realization that the alternative to the old creaky church we had is a slick, slightly gothic version of American civil religion. And with what prayer we have left in us, we pray, let it not be so. I think you have to be disillusioned to be able, and if you're a poet, you can do it that way, and if you're an ordinary person like me, you just find those places where you are counter-culture, where you are a monk, where you are a dissident, which means I don't sit down with you at that point. You're a dissident to values which are contrary to the values you accept in Jesus Christ. And sometimes I think that gets heavy. I'll share with you Thomas Merton, which is the one who was most helpful in my own thinking, and I guess most helpful in the chapter of the book. And he says this, from a monastery in Kentucky, in the midst of the civil rights movement, and no one saw it more clearly, and in the midst of many of the things that took place during the Watergate years, and even before they happened, because he died in 68, but he wrote this. He said, this is what it means to be a contemplative. We must be wary of ourselves when the worst that is in man becomes objectified in society, approved, acclaimed, and deified, when hatred becomes patriotism and murder a holy duty, when spying and delation are called love of truth and the stool pigeon is a public benefactor, when the gnawing and prurient resentments of frustrated bureaucrats become the conscience of the people and the gangster is enthroned in power. Then we must fear the voice of our own heart, even when it denounces them, for are we not all tainted with the same poison? That's why we must not be deceived by the giants and by their thunderous denunciations of one another, their preparations for mutual destruction. The fact that they are powerful does not mean that they are sane, and the fact that they speak with intense conviction does not mean that they speak the truth. If we're called through contemplation to be disillusioned and to a certain extent to be dissidents, I think that has social and political ramifications. I have a quote on someone who thought that the very fact that the church is called to be a contemplative people has that in mind. The rediscovery by the church of its fundamental identity as a contemplative people is not a flight from social political responsibility. On the contrary, once we begin praying again, and once we take seriously the contemplative vision we are heirs to, we become more socially and politically restless than ever. The American denial of its own best dream is built on the premise that no one sees beneath the surface of things. But contemplation sees with the eyes of fire. Everything social and everything political is called into question. Far from amounting to a surrender of involvement in social change, the commitment to a contemplative way of life is a profoundly political act, with specific implications for everything from prison reform to exploitive trade practices. Pascal described the situation when there were no dissidents, when there was no one disillusioned. And he said it this way, when we are seated in a moving vessel and our eyes are fixed upon an object on the same vessel, we do not notice that we are moving. But if we look further upon something that is not moving along with us, for instance, upon the coast, we notice immediately that we're moving. And it's the same with life. When the whole world lives wrongly, we fail to notice it. But should only one person awaken spiritually, the life of all others becomes immediately apparent. And then he adds, and the others always persecute those who do not live like them. Father Dan Berrigan gave a talk one night on the Sermon on the Mount. And in essence, he said that's still what the way is, and we're still called to be followers of the way. He said the church was never told to take a moratorium from what I've just proclaimed in the Sermon on the Mount. And at least one person had the courage and the truthfulness and the honesty to say what he thought at the end of the speech. And he blurted out, Father Berrigan, you priests are so naive. You cannot live that way. In all due respect to what you've said, you cannot live that way. Do you know what would happen if someone tried to take seriously what you said tonight and live the way you said life was supposed to be lived? Father Berrigan said, yes, I know what did happen. I guess I should have started before I talked on the Sermon on the Mount that if anybody wanted to go down this path, before they started, they should make sure they look good on wood. It's the only place it ever did end. And I don't think you start down that path until you have another way of seeing, even seeing life and death and personal security and all kinds of other things. I just don't think you start down that path without a revolution. Many people have said it in many ways, and I'm sure at Holden you get it in different ways. Thoreau's different drummer, I think that's trying to say the same thing, that the revolution is, in his case, he was saying what beat you go by. That's another way of saying how you see. I think one of the delightful stories about Thoreau is he went to prison for his civil disobedience, and Emerson came to see him and said, "Thoreau, what are you doing in there?" And Thoreau said, "What are you doing out there?" That means a different way of seeing. Neither could understand how the other one could be where they were. That means a different way of seeing. Neither could understand how the other one could be where they were. And I guess I believe that when judgment comes, that we may be surprised that we're judged by the ease with which we identify not with the centers of power, but with the prisoners. And I don't know what that means for your life, because I don't know yet what it means for mine. That in the judgment day we'll be judged more by the ease with which we move and identify with prisoners, not with the centers of power, not with the powerful ones. We tend to think that we have arrived when we're comfortable with the power elite. And my understanding of what it means to follow the cross is we should be more and more comfortable with those who are truly dissidents, truly counterculture, not as a fad, but as monks. So I invite you to be contemplative monks, male, female, even have kids and still be one, but basically see it as a new way of seeing and a way to be disillusioned. I also hope that you do understand that our problem with it is probably that contemplation is more simple than we thought, not more complicated than we thought. And let me stress one final thing. I think a contemplative vision helps us keep centered on grace. That without that contemplative vision, peace will be by and large a quest. But with grace, it's primarily a bequest. And it keeps it as receptivity and gift. It helps us take life seriously, but not take ourselves too seriously. And I think that Jim Carroll, in the last thing that we used in the chapter, I'm going to read it even though you're looking at it, because sometimes poetry hits if you hear it. I think he understands the nature of prayer and the nature of grace and a key to the idea of peace in that poem, Sighs Too Deep for Words. If you want to follow, it's on page 89, but if you want to just listen, I think that's all right. Like ourselves, when we try to love each other, air blows cold and hot. We are left wondering if our passions were mistaken, if our loneliness is in the end everything. And God, like ourselves, when we are distant and close at once, he confuses us. Like ourselves, he begins his story with an eye-catching title, then fools us, fading, leaving us asking if this pain we cannot avoid, though we try, Is yearning after him or yearning only after yearning? Is God my pious name for guilt, as the doctor keeps telling me by the way he holds his head? You ask, how do you pray when it's all so foggy? But it's not foggy at all, don't you see? It is clear as air, prayer. How I pray is breathe. I remember the poet Paul, who couldn't shake the faith either, saying, praying, forget praying. The Spirit, breath of God, lives in you, in your bones, in your heart, interrupting God for you all day. Relax, don't worry about it. The Spirit prays for you with sighs too deep for words. Paul, baby, I could kiss you for those lines. Which come, I suspect, more from your insane desire like mine than from any facts you had. Sighs like that I know about. If you tell me those sighs are the breath of God praying, I can believe it. I can believe it. My sighs are warm and cool, death and life, far and near. My sighs always surprise me. For a sigh is what happens when the breath I breathe is not all mine. How I pray is breathe. Knowing the air that brings the world into my soul escapes its hedge with more of me than I knew was there. Whatever reactions, protests, small speeches formed like questions, or anything else that you want, the time is yours. Yes, where?
Marn.
I would like to know if you could expand more on your view of God's peace. And I felt, you know, when we have our church services on Sunday night after during communion, we wish the peace of the Lord to each other. And somehow I feel uncomfortable doing that because I don't feel it's mine to give. And I'm not completely sure what it is I'm offering when I do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's the background behind, that's my speech behind my question.
No, that's a question. I'm not.
I do.
Let me just very briefly give the biblical word is, because I think that's a place to start. I mean, that may sound like a very Sunday school type or exegetical type thing, and not very dynamic. But I hope that that's part of it. Biblically, the word comes much more from the Hebrew. And therefore, I think a study of the word shalom, more than the New Testament, irene, which is picked up and translated peace, but according to Kittle or Bible scholars, it's the depth of shalom that really is the concept that we move into. And it's interesting that Kittle, at the end of the studying of the 350 times shalom is used in the Old Testament, it's a very integral part of the language and the understanding in the Old Testament, says it is never individual, and it is never referring to inward tranquility. It is a social concept, so it's a community phrase. That's the reason that I think it makes the most sense to say it after a Eucharist, to pass it to one another, because it's in that very community relationship that we experience it. So I don't think it's a commodity we're giving one another. We're saying this is the way God's peace comes. It comes in community, and it comes in the breaking of the bread. The first thing that the Old Testament, I think, has as a theme, I tried to say, it is part of covenant. In Isaiah, I will not take the covenant of my shalom from you. It's gift, it's gospel. So it's not a quest, it's a bequest. I think that's one of the major themes. Secondly, in the Old Testament, it's integrally related with the wholeness of all the creation in a way that we have broken. It's an ecological idea. It's an ecosystem. The delicate web of interdependencies. It's the relationship of not only me and other people, but me and the created universe, the animal kingdom. When we were to keep the seventh day holy as a Sabbath in Exodus 23, when those are repeated, it's so that your oxen get a break and a day off. That's very much more part of the Old Testament than ours. But the most consistent theme is a justice theme in the Old Testament, that the litmus test for whether or not God's people were a shalom community is, how does the outcast fare among you? How does the pariah fare when he's in your midst? In other words, the one that the world tends to reject, and many times that's named as the widow and the fatherless, because at that point those would be the outcasts without status. So the test of whether the community was a shalom community was or not was in those justice themes, in the responsibility for caring and concern. That does not mean that God's not interested in my psychological well-being. That's part of my wholeness too. But I think it's important biblically to understand that shalom as a concept was a social concept. Some of these, I think, have reference when Jesus says, "Peace I give you, not as the world gives, give I unto you. Or in the Old Testament, a false prophet was the one who said, "Peace, peace," where there was no peace. Usually, that was to say everything's okay when there was injustice that should have been part of my peace. Do you see the kinds of things that I think become part of the theme? Now, let's get to the other part of that. What does it mean when we say that to one another after a worship service or something? Well, what does it say to you? Either on the basis of what we've just said or on your own understanding. What does it mean to pass the peace?
Well, one of the things that I've come up with the last couple of days has been that you're at peace when you're willing to do, when you're praying, dreaming to do God's will.
Repeat it again.
I'm not quite sure how to phrase this. I've got the concept, but I don't
okay.
know how to put into words about it. When you're praying or willing to do God's will, now, and then, like, pass the peace is to almost, is seems like it would be to will that for another person as well. For all the people you're passing the peace.
Okay.
I don't know, the concept of fullness, which you mentioned, I hadn't thought of before, which you're talking about just now, but that is, you know, if we're at peace, it seems, when we are trying to. I get stuck in language here because I don't like to use much certain language. But when we are trying to, I guess the best I come up with is to do God's will or to live His will, then we're at peace, and we're not at peace whenever we're trying to rebel against it.
Okay.
I like, are you done?
Yeah.
Okay. I like what you said about community. That, I don't know, I could really, you know, I sort of understood that. I think also, it's, I don't know, for me anyway, you know, all I can just say is what I feel when we're doing it. And that community, what you said about the community, I think it hit me because sort of, well, the community you just have with just each person that you share the peace with. Like, if you stay up till 2 in the morning the night before, or a couple days before Sunday, talking to somebody, then sharing that peace is going to be a very special thing that Sunday. And likewise, if you have a bad argument or things aren't really right between you and another person, either you might try to avoid that person, or else you might look at that person and smile, and, you know, things will be all right. You know, I get a real sense of community. Going on an individual basis to every person, you get a real sense of community out of that whole feeling.
Okay.
What strikes me, though, that it's the shalom, it's the, one of the most critical factors of justice. We really haven't caused for peace. That that kind of peace.
Go ahead. In what ways? Like,
you know, if we want to stay in our, if we want to confine ourselves even to two of us, we find that there is injustice happening all the time. So if we go farther than that, and I hope we do, I understand, you know, we must identify with the rest of the world. And that, you know, the outcasts in this world are never have and never will be getting the kind of fair deal that they deserve to have. So it sounds to me like peace is something like the class of society.
Like the classless society?
Yeah, so something that's apocalyptic, that will only come after the second coming, that we can never hope to experience this side of grace if we experience it on the other side. I don't know.
Well, I think there's a couple things that you've raised. First of all, the people who would say that we dare not talk as though we had peace when we live in a world in which two-thirds of the people on this globe are hungry. I mean, if you're beginning to sense why one of the chapters is fat sheep, lean sheep, that's very much part of shalom and peace. That it does include, because of its wholeness, it does include my bodily needs. Those are included in God's understanding of peace. And to say peace, peace, where there is no peace, is still the cry of prophets, Hosea, Amos, still announcing to the rich. And we hope on Saturday to take world hunger as a specific issue. And it seems to me it's a peace issue when the pets in America do better than one out of every eight human beings that share this globe with us. And that's literally a fact. All right. To say peace, peace, where there is no peace would be a denial of the biblical concept. Now, okay, so that's part of what. Secondly, do we ever experience this perfectly, or will we come to it in this world, or all those other things? Is it more disturbing to you, or more kind of guilt-producing, or legalism rather than grace, to think of peace where we've kind of lived with, we will never have perfectness of anything else, like love will never be perfect, but that's still God's gift, and we feel that we're part of his plan when we accept more and more of that gift? I mean, is there a different feeling you get from that new understanding, or not new necessarily for you, but a re-understanding of peace as over against some other things which are God's will, which are never going to be perfect here? I mean, I'm trying to find out why that hits you so differently from hearing a sermon on love and our call to love, or the Sermon on the Mount, you must be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. And unless you all have met somebody in the last month that I haven't met, we haven't gotten there yet. Does it strike you as different from some other tensions or dilemmas that we have with being and yet not being, or becoming what we already are? And maybe some of that's double talk for our old problems, but
I think it's the way that the temptation to use abuse the peace of the Lord, in the sense that,
okay, all right,
you know, it's a cozy way to greet your friends and enemies. Bothers me, and that, you know, it's a piece of God's peace is important to remember, because otherwise, I think I'm very horrified at the thought of being stuffed in a very nice but closed up religious closet with a bunch of other really nice people sharing peace.
Okay.
And that, I guess that, that's why I felt the shalom in terms of justice is something that has to really hurt.
Okay, that I share. That shalom can be the new N-word. That the scandal of the cross is gone when it's costume jewelry, and the cutting edge of shalom is gone when it's in every gift show in New York on some kind of new art, and it's hanging on the walls of every home. I mean, that so easily we take something and diffuse it. That I understand. I just got a letter from a friend, and he signed it Shalom, and said in parenthesis, "I really mean that. We've had a fairly good month. Love, Larry." The story behind it is I ended a conference on shalom by saying, look, no matter what I've said, you all are going to take this thing as too spiritual and too religious, and you're not going to let it be what it is in the Old Testament. If you ever write to me and sign it shalom with your name, that means when I get the letter, if I don't have any money, I can have some of yours. So he wrote it, and then he put in parenthesis, and I mean it.
Okay.
But somehow we have to, now that's a facetious way, somehow you have to have some ways in which you remind yourself of what it means so it doesn't get to be a cheap word, or that the church is renewed when we pass the peace with a hug and a guitar takes the place, and all those other things that don't necessarily mean that there has been that revolution of a new way of seeing or a new reality. Okay. Yeah, I agree there. That doesn't solve all the problems that you raise. What other reactions do you have? We don't have to stay on the word peace or shalom. What other things about contemplative vision or a new way of seeing or what that revolution would mean? Or are there other things that you want to pick up on? Yes.
I hate to display my ignorance, but who is Thomas Merton?
Thomas Merton was a Trappist Cistercian monk. His autobiographical book that would let you know his life best is called Seven Story Mountain. Went into the monastery kind of a rebellious person, many years till he wrote. And then in the 50s and the 60s, a prolific writer, especially in regard to contemplative living, to the combination, he has one book called Contemplatives in a World of Action, or Contemplative Living in a World of Action, and was on the verge of really making a bridge between East and West, has books on Zen that are just beautiful, depth of understanding, and was respected throughout the world. I have a book, the bibliography of things Merton wrote took, I think, 12 pages at the back of the book. So we're just finding him. It isn't because he didn't write. We're just finding him. New Seeds of Contemplation, Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander are now kind of popular paperbacks. He was on his way to the East to visit with some, I think, either Zen or Hindu people at a kind of conference, and was standing on a tile floor, and apparently with some moisture on it, plugged in an electric fan or turned the switch and was electrocuted in a freak accident in 1968. But a profound person. Lived at Gethsemane Abbey in Kentucky for most of those times, and with the, permissions of the elders of that monastery, for the last few years was really solitary. Built a little cabin for himself, even away from the monks, as a hermit. But beautiful writing. I don't know if you have any, where's Meredith? Have any Thomas Merton?
We do.
You do?
We have a Seven-Story Mountain.
Seven-Story Mountain?
It's in the library, too. Somewhere.
Okay. If you want to start, the Seven Story Mountain is his autobiographical, his life. If you want to start with his diary or his journal, start with Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander. Just, you know, things he wrote, page, three sentences, you can pick it up anytime, and you really kind of get into him with his journal entries during the 50s.
Aren't a lot of his things specifically for monks? The
reason that he has so much that's specifically for monks and novices is he was novice master for a long time, and the tapes of his lectures to new novitiates are now all published, and those are not nearly as helpful. No, there are at least 30 titles for popular, that were not aimed at people living a monastic life that are very, very fine. I think he's going to be one of the real influences, even in the, I think like New Seeds of Contemplation will someday be in the classics of contemplative or monastic writing. Other questions? There would be no reason why you should have known him. You don't have to apologize for asking for Thomas Merton.
Maybe I could ask a little bit about you and what you're doing now and where you're heading as far as your ideas for political and social action and also religious reforms.
During the 60s, we lived in the middle of Washington, D.C., and I think that where we now are is partly because of those years, the church active on the streets, protest movements, the civil rights and welfare reform and the Poor People's Campaign and the demonstrations against Vietnam. And at the end of that period, I think we really had a time when we tried to reflect upon what that experience meant, tried to say where that brings us now. I think at the end of the 60s, people who were active in it either did a lot of that reflection, or they are, like a Catholic priest friend of mine from those years said, John, all my liberal friends are basket cases. That those years either brought some kind of reflection or else people are kind of wiped out. So we were very interested in doing that kind of reflection. And because of that, moved from D.C. and from a very active life to some time on a farm in West Virginia, which is still our home. The ministry that I have now is a ministry for peace and nonviolence funded by the American Lutheran Church. Other places, you'd understand it, but other places, in order for them to get some idea of what I'm doing, I say I'm paid to do things like be at Holden Village. Then they understand the nature of the grant. And if they feel ripped off by that, I kid them a little more and say, no, really what I'm paid to do, the American Lutheran Church pays me to sit in a rocking chair in front of a cabin in West Virginia, rocking slowly and writing strong sermons on commitment. And if they're still with me, then we can talk. Otherwise they wouldn't understand. Okay. I think we are more and more seeing that maybe nonviolence and the resistance movement for the 70s, rather than the sit-in, which was the result of an analysis of the civil rights movement, I mean, it was an action that flowed from our analysis, that more and more for the 70s, the nonviolent resistance movement is in this new way of seeing and finding ways that we are a dissident to some prevailing values in the United States. I don't know what form that will take. There's a kind of consistent theme, though, and I guess you'll sense it this week, that in World Hunger we spend more time on our overconsumption rather than their overpopulation or their underdevelopment. In other words, I think the place to start is the place where we can do the most about it, or our own lifestyle. That most of the invitations that I get now have to do with the theology of enough or the kind of lifestyle. If you find yourself in the midst of the affluent nation, which we do, in the first world, which is where we live, but have a Christian faith, what does that say about a lifestyle? If you are the affluent nation, but as Maren asked, are more and more aware that you live in the midst of a very hungry world, what does that say about the way we live? That's the main point at which we are asked to do some thinking and teaching. Now, maybe you had other things in mind, but that's a... We try not to use a West Virginia mountain home as the model. I mean, I try to use lifestyle changes and make them all urban examples, because our move to West Virginia was a very practical thing of the only place we really could live without some kind of income. We wanted to do this, and we didn't have anybody paying us to do it. So we changed our lifestyle for a while to get rid of the need of a lot of cash. Other questions or comments? It's 5:00. Is that supposed to be the end of this for everybody, or should some go and others can stay?
I'll just say, I was looking forward to hearing you talk about this, because when I heard you a couple years ago, you were just coming out. I mean, I think you were still living in West Virginia, and talking about the simple life seems to fit right in with what you were trying to do. But now hearing about the schedule that you've been trying, I mean, with your grant and doing all this traveling, you have to have some kind of a contemplative vision to keep the simple life.
Ivan Illich, I think, refuses to go anywhere that he can't get to. He refuses to go anywhere if he can't get there by bicycle from Cuernavaca, from his center. He refuses to jet around the world and talk about the energy crisis and all of the other things. And I feel that contradiction, but I don't know what to do about it, other than maybe the gospel means, instead of always doing the right thing without any error to it or guiltless, that what it says is you can live with those contradictions or fall flat on your face and stand up again or something. We will be back in West Virginia by the summer, and this has been a kind of unusual part in it. But simplicity of lifestyle, I don't think, can mean avoidance of the complexities of the problem. And therefore, I think that way of seeing, or the contemplative vision, is part of it. I will be glad to be back in the dirt in West Virginia, I'll say that. I mean, I think you find your calling and find the place that you function and live there. Not everybody is called to be a solitary or to be a hermit, and not everybody's called to do this or that, but you kind of find your way to do it. And I enjoy the traveling and the meeting of people, but it brings complications to the simple life. I get kidded about it a lot. So if it brings people a sense of humor about the contradiction, maybe that's one of the pluses to it. To give you some idea of what we had planned to do, and then you might get a better sense of the week. Wanted to take the theology of enough tomorrow. The bookstore again has, like, Mankind at the Turning Point, which is the Club of Rome report.